dying, Father, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I had the feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I am here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lines to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact life. And that is why you are here.
Today I know the future. This is Red Ice Radio. For the Seeker.
And knowing what I must strive to know.
Well, hello there, ladies and gentlemen. Greetings and welcome. I hope you're having a good spring equinox and that you're ready for spring. My name is Henrik Palmgren and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. We are based out of Sweden, but we are available worldwide through our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. We do interviews with interesting and fascinating people on many of the topics that we find interesting and important. Today, we're talking with Scott Bardle from Australia. He is behind the film What the Fuck, F-U-Q, and that stands for Frequently Unanswered Questions of the Australian Government, a documentary questioning those claiming government status as to whether they really are government. Scott has been on a very interesting journey and a process trying to import a 1959 Chevrolet Corvette into Australia. The Department of Transport has been blocking import. The Department of Environment are getting in the way. Customs demands goods and services tax and luxury car tax. It's been a bureaucratic nightmare that have been unfolding for Scott. And along the way, he has been discovering some pretty notable details as to whom he really has been dealing with. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Scott Bardle. It's good to have you with us. Thank you for taking the time talking with us here today.
Henrik, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You bet. I watched your film again last night. I've seen it previously. We linked it up on our website, redicecreations.com, a while back, and it's a fascinating one. It's really well made, and it's funny along the way, and it's just a very, very interesting story overall. And I think we should go through it, the background, if you will, a little bit here in the beginning, Scott, and let's not assume that some of our listeners have seen the whole film yet or understood the whole backstory here. So tell us about the car, I guess. We can begin there, if you don't mind then, Scott.
Sure. The car is a 1959 Chevrolet Corvette, and absolutely fell in love with that car over in the States. And the challenge was to get it into Australia. And at that point, I believed I needed a import approval from the Department of Transport. So that was my first roadblock, and I applied under their scheme that was in place. And I was rejected by the Department of Transport, and they quoted from this pre-1989 scheme. And so I thought, hang on, no, I thought I followed this pretty closely, and wrote back to them and requested a review, and they rejected it again, quoting from their same scheme. And the only avenue available open to me after that was to take them through the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. So I pursued that angle, and that was a three-month process. And in going through that, what ended up was basically, through some very sneaky wording by the Department of Transport's lawyers, which I was able to recognise because of going through this with a very tight fine-tooth comb, was they basically pulled the guidelines from me and said, sorry, you can't rely upon those. They're not law. And yet they'd quoted from them twice to refuse my import approval previously. And so this was ringing off all sorts of alarm bells in my mind as to what's going on here. And so that set me on the path really to starting to ask some deeper questions when further roadblocks came up with regard to the air conditioner within the car and then also customs a little bit further down the track. Did you want me to go into the aircon saga as well?
Yeah, let's do that. It's a funny one, and I think it's a good place to kind of begin as you do in the film as well. So tell us about that.
Okay. The next roadblock was after I'd inquired as to all of the permits and payments that I'd require to go through to actually get the car into Australia. And by this stage, I knew to ask thorough questions. So I'd asked for every single payment that I was required to make. And next thing you know, we got the car finally shipped over to Australia and it's sitting in Fremantle in the customs warehouse. And I find out that there's another charge for a pre-charged equipment license, basically a license surrounding or importing the air conditioner. And at that point, I'm like, hang on, this is pretty wrong finding out about that at this point in time, because my only options, according to them, was to either pay this license or to pay a mechanic to degas the air conditioner. So I was kind of in a catch-22 scenario. Now, based on the information that I'd been researching and finding when dealing with the Department of Transport, I thought, hang on, I'm going to start asking a few questions here, because I'd been finding little giveaway signs that things weren't quite right when I'm seeing a copyright symbol next to the Commonwealth of Australia and finding out that the kangaroo and the emu, the coat of arms, was a registered trademark, registered with the United States Patent and Trademark Office. And then I found we've got a company called the Commonwealth of Australia registered with the Securities Exchange Commission in Washington, D.C., and all of these things were just shaping up as, hang on a minute, have we got a company that's pretending to be the Commonwealth of Australia and I'm actually paying a company instead of the Commonwealth comprised of the people? And basically I thought, okay, well, here's my opportunity with the Department of Unlawful Air Conditioning, as I nicknamed them. And I wrote to them and said, look, demonstrate, please, that you are actually working from the for the Commonwealth comprised of the people, or without any evidence, I'm going to presume that you're working for this one over in Washington. And it didn't take very long at all, and I got a letter back, and I found out that I was exempt. I'd been exempt from this pre-charged equipment license. They'd conveniently recategorized my car as a personal effect. I'm like, hang on a minute. A personal effect is like a toothbrush or necklace. Like, nah. So, yeah, that was a win. I didn't end up having to pay any of their license fees. And I subsequently found out that lots and lots of other people, basically all of those who didn't ask any questions, were having to pay that license fee. Their car wasn't categorized as a personal effect. Mine was. I thought, oh, okay, let's keep pursuing this. And so when customs came along, I asked them the same sort of questions. Now, whilst I had this win up my sleeve from the Department of Unlawful Air Conditionings, customs dug their heels in and didn't respond at all. And so I went through a process of basically giving them the opportunity to demonstrate that they were real government and not just a company pretending to be government. And they sat there absolutely stone cold silent. Now, the process that I used was the same sort of process that courts use. Your debt collectors use it. It's the silence is the acceptance. And I think even in the law dictionaries, you see, the Latin phrase, qui non negat fatitur, he who does not deny admits.
Mm.
And so there's this process that's used against us, which is being treated with absolute contempt and disregard by customs. And so I pursued with it and said, look, well, if it's good enough for you guys to use against us, good enough for me to use with you,
right?
referring to customs. And so I formalized the fact that they were acting in the capacity of a company and offered them terms and conditions. And subsequent to that, I invoiced them for holding my car based on an unsubstantiated act or unlawfully, and began invoicing them. And each of my invoices, I offered them a waiver to demonstrate that they were actually real government, gave them a way out, which you'd think if anyone was faced with an invoice that had your name on it, you'd want to be dealing with it pretty quick. And yet customs just sat there quite arrogantly, no, absolutely stone cold silent. And ironically, in complete contravention to their own client service charter, which proudly announced that they would respond within 5 business days. So I think I went 59 days without getting a response. It was only once I sent them the final notice on one of my invoices that I finally got a response. So it was fairly arrogant, the whole process all the way through.
Now, tell our listeners a little bit more about your background. I mean, you're familiar with maritime law. You've previously been used to dealing with customs and border protection. So what do you do previously, Scott?
Right. Well, I did originally a degree in project management. Worked in mining and later worked all the way up to captain aboard luxury mega yachts, like 200-foot, $100 million mega yachts with helicopters and recording studios and you name it. So I'd cruised through 40-odd countries around the world dealing with immigration and customs and maritime procedures and law of the sea and all sorts of interactions out on the ocean. So I was probably no stranger to foreign laws and customs and how all of those things operated on a worldwide scale. And so perhaps the other thing was that the clientele or the ownership of those luxury yachts were pretty fussy. And so as a result of that, I needed to be fairly particular in the level of detail that I was operating at. And perhaps that's why I was quite fussy when it came to some of these documents I was starting to deal with Australian customs.
Now, had you previously ever seen anything like this in your work? I mean, this scenario with the import of what they classify as a luxury car here, were you handled differently here?
Yeah, I suppose in the imports that I'd been looking at, most of it was handled by an agent and a broker. And any delays were primarily just due to shipping or postal services, or in the case of Spain, the mañana effect, or their laid back kind of lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
But no, nothing. I'd never encountered anything quite as drastic as I'd experienced with so called Australian customs.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems to be a huge hassle to import things, at least into certain countries. I mean, I've told the story briefly before, but I've some of our listeners might not. I imported a cat from America to Sweden, and it was one of the most gruesome experiences I've ever been through. And the paperwork was just incredible. I had probably 150 pages after all when we were done with everything, and fees to the left, right, and center, all over the place.
Yep.
So why is it so difficult to import something? What is going on here, Scott?
Well, from what I've found is it's not necessarily the process of going through and doing it that's the difficulty comes from, I think, just roadblocks put in place that allows various money grabs to be made at various points along the way. I mean, I'm struggling to put it any politer than that.
Well, that's polite enough, I think. You know, it's that's what I felt too, Scott, when I was going through this. It's every step along the way, there's someone who has a fee to collect. And what I saw is that this is like a, you know, this is the personification of the service economy, if you will. You are doing all the work, but you're paying everyone else to basically give their approval for you to do the work. You know what I mean?
Well, what I found was, and this has been my principle all the way along, is that I'm not avoiding paying this money. I'm happy to pay the taxes where they're due, and so that they go to the right people. However, what I found was that I wasn't given the evidence that I was actually paying the right people, that my monies were going elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I objected to. I basically said, no, I've had enough of that idea. I'm not participating in that. I'm happy to pay my money that'll benefit my neighbours in that sort of environment. But you want to start pretending that you're someone else and you can't substantiate that you're real government, that's where I draw the line.
So tell us what happened here and how you discovered, you know, some of these signs, basically, that we have an entity, I guess, posing as government. And a little bit later, Scott, I wanted to try to get into possibly when this happened, if there indeed was a switch here at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I suppose the giveaways, the way I presented it in that documentary was kind of like I've stumbled on a lot of this stuff. Now, I'd been researching a lot of this for a lot longer, and the material that I presented in that documentary was not new. It's not like I've discovered it. I would say that the way that I presented it in that documentary was quite novel, in as much as it's a very good intro for a lot of people to actually realize what's happening. But some of the things that I was noticing was you go into the websites of these so-called government departments, and you've got a corporate charter, you've got a client service charter, you've got an Australian business number, you've got a chief executive officer. All of these things on their own, okay, you can sort of say, well, that's necessary because of blah, blah, blah. The overall feel I got was that I'm dealing with a company here. And when I actually put that to the various departments, and so far, I think since doing that documentary, I've been exposed to helping other folk challenge the various different departments, and up to 50 or so of them, not one of them have been able to demonstrate that they are real government. And to do that, actually, we boiled it down to one simple question. In Australia, at least, it boils down to one question that can be asked to determine whether you're dealing with real government or not. I don't know whether you wanted to get into that one.
Well, let's do it. What is that?
Okay, well, there's two aspects to government in Australia. You've got the office and an office holder. So an example of the office is a court, and an office holder would be the judge. Now, the same thing you could say with taxation. The office is the Australian Taxation Office, and the office holder is the Commissioner of Taxation. Both the office and the office holder ultimately are given their authority to be government by the sanction of the governor of each state, or at the federal level or Commonwealth level, by the Governor General. So the Governor General would ascribe royal assent to any act that set up an office, and he would also appoint or commission the commissioner, or he'd appoint a judge or a minister or anything like that. So the bottleneck goes all the way back to the governor or the governor general. Now, the governor general gets his authority from the office of governor or governor general. So, again, you've got the office and the office holder. In this case, we've got the office of the governor and Governor General, and the actual Governor or Governor General as the office holder. And that's the key, is the office of the Governor General. Now, that originally was constituted in Australia by Queen Victoria back in 1900, and she spelled out some very specific things within the document that constituted that office. One of them was that that office was permanent, except if it were that document was revoked, altered, or amended by an heir and successor to her,
mm-hmm.
in full accordance with the power and authority reserved by her back in 1900. And so that just provided us with one simple question to be able to ask, is were those original letters patent revoked, altered, or amended by an heir and successor in accordance with the full power and authority reserved back in 1900? And that was as simple as it got. The presumption that we've been left with is in the 80s approximately, for the Commonwealth level or the federal level, 1984 was a document that supposedly revoked those letters patent, and yet there's a whole bunch of inconsistencies with it. And when you ask that one question as were those original ones of 1900 revoked, everyone who you ask ducks and dives and dodges and goes and gets as far out of your way as possible without answering that question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the documents in 1984 were legitimate, you would think that they'd be able to go, yeah, sure. Yeah, look, see, it says on here that that was the case. And look, there's the stamp from the UK, because that's where they constitute the office of the Queen's representative. It's got to come from the UK. Here it all is. Look, yep, and that's legitimate. And yet the response that we've got when you ask that one question is very evasive. And recently one governor actually was ballsy enough to put in writing, I will not be answering that question.
Hmm.
Well, okay.
Huh.
You have answered it. Thank you.
What does that mean to you, Scott? What does this mean that this is when the switch that we were talking about earlier actually potentially might have happened, and you've found pretty much the date, I guess, here then?
It's one form of switch.
Yeah.
There's more, it gets deeper into banking. However, what this means is essentially in 1900 you have that office that was established. And if you visualize a timeline drawn from 1900 with the wording that it's the permanent provision for the office of governor, then that timeline would run all the way through till now, unless it were revoked, altered, or amended, in which case it would stop whenever it was revoked and the new timeline for the new office would start. What we've got is, without evidence of the original office being revoked, a timeline going from 1900 till now, and in addition, we've got another timeline that starts somewhere in 1984, and depending on which state, other different timelines, but say for the federal Commonwealth level, 1984, another timeline. And from that timeline, you've got the constitution of various, or the commissioning of various commissioners, the appointment of various judges, ministers, various acts that are ascribed royal assent by a governor, operating from a timeline that is parallel to the original one. And so when you ask them, which timeline are you operating on? Are you operating on the original one? And was that ever revoked? And if they can't give you evidence that it was revoked, then that timeline runs all the way through till today.
Hmm.
That's where you get this parallel office. And so when you look at the corporate overlay, you can see it, you visualize it as a corporate fog that's layered over the top of the real office. And all we can see now is through the interactions that we've got is the corporate office. And yet underneath is an abandoned original constitutional office. And I think you'll find the same thing happens in New Zealand and Canada and some of the other Commonwealth nations.
Interesting. I did a search on it's called EDGAR, the search engine there on sec.gov, the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yep.
And I found the Kingdom of Sweden on there, and I you know, I try to figure out what does it mean? Wait a minute, does this mean that they're just doing, you know, business with them in some way, that they've registered because some of the money from the country is being used? What does that mean? I have no idea what that means. Why are countries showing up on that list there?
It's rather interesting, yes. Now, you get some people who say, oh, but it's for trading of bonds.
Mm.
Now, there's a few folk who can give an explanation of what exactly that means by bonds, down to the point where they might even be demonstrating the trading of birth certificate bonds. But if we want to keep it fairly simplistic, we do a little bit of an exploration into banking. And what I believe happened was, if you look at back at the original treasuries that the countries used to have, the treasury was printing the currency, and they would bring money into existence to spend on infrastructure projects. And I believe there's some early projects back in Australia, like the Snowy River, Snowy Mountains Water Scheme, and a railway project that was financed by or through the Treasury at some point. What that did was, essentially, you didn't have a taxpayer, because the money was printed by the government treasury, spent on infrastructure projects, and there was no taxpayer required, and there was no borrowings that were involved. The money was circulated, and the value of the country was reflected by the amount of assets and the bridges and the roads and the infrastructure and that sort of thing. At some point in time, someone managed to convince the governments that that was no longer a good idea, and that you had to get your money from private banks. So the private banks began printing the money, lent it to the governments, and they disguised that by buying bonds, at which point the banks gave the governments money, the governments gave the banks bonds. Now, in that sense, what happened was that the Treasury and the government had to repay this money back to the banks. Now, that was all well and good, in as much as, well, unfortunately, to do that, they needed a taxpayer. When the Treasury was printing the money in the first place, there was no taxpayer needed. So now suddenly we have a need for a taxpayer. And you look back, and coincidentally, I think in Australia we've got the Income Tax Assessment Act of 1936. And even in the States, I think their income tax laws only came in 33 or something
like that. Something like that, yeah.
So before then, didn't need income tax. So here we go. We're now paying tax to be able to pay these private banks back. But the little complication is that the private banks have also been charging interest. Now, the difficulty here is that interest was never circulated in the economy for the likes of you and I to earn, to be able to pay it back to the government in tax, to be able to pay that back to the private bank as those interest payments. What that meant was there was no way in hell that the governments were ever going to pay back the amount of money that they borrowed from the private banks plus interest. It just wasn't going to happen. So it spiraled out of control, that the only way you could pay it back was borrowing more to pay back, borrow, pay back, borrow, pay back, until the where you go bankrupt as a country. Now, my thoughts are that that happened around about 1929-33, around the Great Depression or so.
Yeah.
And the way I'm thinking this works is that at that point, what the private banks did was institute a administrator for a bankrupt country. And that's where your corporate government came along. That's your administrator for your bankrupt country. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, it does.
Now, whether or not that's the case or not, that's just my thoughts on that.
Yeah.
And it appears to make sense, in as much as we've got this corporate registration And I wouldn't be surprised if at some point you traced Sweden's history back, you find a similar sort of thing.
Yeah.
With private banks and that sort of thing. Now, a document that we came across fairly recently here in Australia relates to the Uniform Commercial Code, and it links the big banks of Australia to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And I suppose the background to that is if you go and take out a loan to borrow money for a car, the bank has, at least in Australia recently, they register a security interest in your car, which is the collateral. They are the secured party and you are the debtor, in as much as you supposedly have a debt to the bank. And I say supposedly, because that's a whole different kettle of fish. But basically, you're the debtor, the bank's the secured party with an interest registered in the collateral, which is the car. Now, you can't sell that car until that security interest has been removed, and the security interest or the debt is proportional to the size of the collateral. Such that if you wanted to borrow more money, they'd want to register more collateral. So that's an example that we're all familiar with. This document that we came across recently with regard to the big banks in Australia and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York lists, save the likes of Westpac Bank here in Australia as the debtor, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York as the secured party, and the interest or the collateral that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has a secured interest in is effectively every single piece of collateral, asset, instrument, document, loan, bond, you name it, that Westpac owns or will own in the future. Now, I think that's probably best summed up by the word everything. And you then ask the question, well, what is the obligation from this big Australian bank, Westpac, to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that requires the registration of such a massive amount of collateral?
Mm.
And what it's shaping up like is that one of the aspects that is regarded as collateral is the something called chattel paper. And if you follow through the definitions within the Uniform Commercial Code, which is the rules by which that filing has been made, you end up with a definition of goods, and you also end up with a term which talks about the unborn young of animals.
Hmm. Chattel paper, is that how you say it?
Chattel. So essentially, what it's shaping up as is the people or living human beings are chattel, where part of the collateral that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has secured.
Hmm.
It's a scary kind of proposition.
Yeah, it is. But Waldo, it would explain, though, why governments all over the world are basically broke, as it seems. I mean, countries get further in debt, as you say, all the time. And although, as a country in Sweden, where taxes are so incredibly high that people don't, you know, have any money over at the end of the day to spend on themselves, you know, their family or their children, they're still homeless people, and the country economically is you know, paddling backwards. And Sweden is actually, comparatively speaking to other European countries, doing fairly well. So this is, we're talking about an illegit government in place, works as a corporate entity. What do you see as some of the ways out of the situation? Stop paying these companies, stop paying these unlawful taxes? What do you think?
Well, yes, in the end. And yet for a lot of people, they are looking for a reason to be able to do that. So I'd say there's a bridge to be built to reach that space where people are comfortable to make those decisions. Now, fortunately in Australia, we've been able to determine a very simple way of of determining whether you've got a corporate pretender or real government. So essentially, the tool that we used there, and I'll speak in principle so that this can apply to more countries than just Australia.
Well, okay, that's a good point. Let me just quickly bring that up. I don't want to want you to lose your point here, but is there a completely different rule set for how the Commonwealth works as opposed to many other countries? And maybe it's not even difficult for you to answer, considering that there are so many, you know, there are so many different countries out there that operate differently. But, you know, kind of peripherally, do you know how that works?
I think a lot of the Commonwealth countries work on a similar sort of template. The specifics will be unique to each country. I do believe that the overall principle is that all the countries are operating with a corporate government that's pretending to be real.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, exactly how that's determined or identified in some countries, I'm not up to speed with that. However, I think if you can, well, actually, there is one methodology and rather or very interesting information that's only came on the scene in December last year of the One People's Public Trust, where they essentially found that all of these corporate governments trace back up through, in one shape or form, to the Bank of International Settlements. And the way loans were created, or when I say loans, I'm kind of putting that in inverted commas when I say that myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The research was done to basically find out whether these loans really were loans and what was going on. And quite a lot of investigations went on and found that basically the value, which really resided in the people. And if we go briefly back to that example where I said the Treasury printed the money to spend on bridges and infrastructure, the paper that the Treasury printed wasn't of value. All it was a representation of the energy and effort expended by the people who were building the bridge.
Mm.
So the real value is actually the people. And that's where we, I think, are missing a lot of this whole idea about money. We keep looking to even things like gold and putting the value in the intrinsic nature of the gold. That, in its way, is only a representation of the energy and effort that belongs to the humans that expend that energy. We are the value. And the instant a private bank came along and said, you have to borrow from me and pay me back with interest, is tantamount to taking that energy and effort away from the people and then having them to work to get it back again. So I definitely suggest people have a look into the origin of the money and the value. And I think they'll find that ultimately it comes back to the people and the energy and the effort that they expend. And money is just a representation of that energy.
Very good. Let me ask you this. The Bank for International Settlements, as you mentioned, is you know, kind of a, well, it's an agreement, at least officially, that was established in 1930. So the timeline right there is fairly correct to what you mentioned earlier. But the founding states was Germany, Belgium, France, Great Britain, Northern Ireland, Italy, Japan, and Switzerland. And they're based in Switzerland today, of course, but in Basel. But how do you think that this ended up being handled in, well, is it Washington, D.C., or is it New York with the Federal Reserve Bank? Is this just a company moving location, pretty much? What do you think?
Well, I think I have had a poke around in the annual report for the Bank of International Settlements, and they've got a number of members, inclusive of the central banks of the world and the Federal Reserve Banks of the U.S., So I believe Bank of International Settlements was the central bank for the world's central banks, almost like a nexus point where everything's funneled up to that point. And so the investigations that I'm referring to, you can actually read up on those through researching a document called the Paradigm Report that was prepared by the One People's Public Trust. And they did a whole series of investigations and in the end ended up putting a series of allegations to the Bank of International Settlements for rebuttal that they were not essentially running a slavery system. And to me, I looked at the what they meant by a slavery system as any system where there was no remedy available to you. And that was exactly what I was finding with my Corvette and customs here in Australia, in as much as the same so-called Governor General who constituted the act that brought customs into existence was the same Governor General who constituted the courts and appointed the judges. So if the validity of the guy for customs was the same guy as the appointed the courts and set those up, I was in a situation where I couldn't take customs to court. My hands were tied. I had no remedy. That to me is a slavery system. And so similar sort of things were put to the Bank of International Settlements, albeit on a much grander scale and at a higher level up the tree. And basically they failed to demonstrate that they weren't actually participating in a slavery system. And from what I understand is if they'd even attempted to try and talk their way out of it, they were incriminating themselves to the point where it was a lose-lose for them in whatever they do. And so what happened with the One People's Public Trust was they foreclosed upon the Bank of International Settlements on behalf of the people of the planet and set up a trust to return the assets that were stolen. And again, if we go back to the energy being the real value, and every time you go along to a bank to borrow, as an example of that system in action, when you've got to borrow something that was originally your energy in the first place, and you've got to try and borrow that back. And I know this is a very brief kind of description that I'm giving here, that it's quite a solid sort of concept to work with, and it's quite mind-boggling in many aspects.
Indeed, and at the same time as I'm listening to this, it's all well and good on paper, but the question goes down to ultimately same scenarios with your car. They ultimately hold your car from you. Ultimately, this is by force. They have monopoly on violence and I mean, they have atom bombs at their disposal, for Christ's sake, and just like the Iraq War was you know, unlawful or illegal, they took down Gaddafi in the same way, and they are holding your car in the same way. So can we fight this on paper? I guess that's my question as well.
I would say in answer to that, yes, you're right. They have the force presently. As far as the paper, I would say that the paper is a representation again of our intent behind where we want to go with this. We can use the paper as a tool to express our intent to the saying of no more. And ultimately that's where they have derived their power from, is us giving our consent. Now, it just happens that they've got 7 billion of us quietly having given our consent by not saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing more and more people starting to take notice and step up to the plate and say, actually, no. And the ways in which people can do that are very varied. It comes from doing what I've done of submitting terms and conditions to these companies, pretending to be governments and saying, look, this is how companies deal with each other. You deal with terms and conditions. Here are mine, and I'm going to invoice you for every time you perform one of the actions that's accepting my terms and conditions, to simple folk who are asking questions of their local government or their ministers or whatever and saying, excuse me, sir, could you please explain this? And for those people who are taking those actions, my suggestion would be not to focus on the detail of the matter that's being addressed. For example, if you ask, why are we charged 10% for this tax and not 5%? The presumption that exists there is that that tax is perfectly legitimate.
Legitimate, yeah, exactly.
Now, you might consider asking something at the level of, could you please demonstrate your authority to be able to levy that tax? At that level, you're not going with any presumptions of legitimacy. You're really going to the core of the matter and asking for evidence of that thing. So a lot of folk can get bogged down with the detail and say, oh, but under this rule that and under that rule that. Go right to the very origins of it and say, well, how did this rule actually come into place? Where did that law come from? And work its way back and poke around and start asking some questions. And if the answers you're getting from some of these so-called public servants are not acceptable, well, you're helping in a very big way, and it's just by asking questions.
And even how it's being used, who's going to benefit from my effort or you know, your labor equity, if you will, how is that going to be used elsewhere, and how can that be just taken from you without your agreement again, and put somewhere else by someone who you don't even know, you know, who it is, basically.
Exactly. Now there's some very fascinating documents, and that one I mentioned about the big four banks in Australia, tying back to the Federal Reserve in New York. I've actually got a list of, I think, a couple of hundred odd banks that also tie back to the Federal Reserve. And if I just do a quick little search, mm-hmm. I may well be able to pull up one for Sweden.
Cool.
What's the name of a big bank in Sweden?
Well, that would be Riksbanken, R-I-K-S. As in Riks, and then Banken, B-A-N-K-E-N.
Okay.
And that's the national, you know, what do you call it, the central bank, basically, of Sweden. We, by the way, have the oldest central bank in the world. It goes back to 1684, I think, if I'm remember correctly.
Okay. What about the Svenska Handelsbanken?
Sure, that's another big one, Handelsbanken, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, I just found them. They have a financing statement registered with the Washington, D.C. UCC registry, and that is showing, and I bet pounds to peanuts, that will have a similar situation where the amount of collateral that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has registered over that bank is everything. So I'll send you the document numbers, and that you can have a look at. The unfortunate thing is, through that registry, you've got to register to be able to search.
Yeah.
And then when you do search, all you get is the index number for a filing, like the number I just sent via Skype, and then you've got to pay another $4. I mean, it's peanuts, but it's just a little inconvenience to get there.
Well, that's worth it just to get the knowledge and to begin to poke around a little bit, take a look.
The other one is Skandinaviska Enskilda Banken.
That's right, SEB they go for short right now. And that was actually, I think that originally was part of the Riksbanken, the central bank, as I mentioned before. But yeah, that's another big one you mentioned.
I'll send you the number for that one. So there's
thanks.
Two straight off for... Sweden and
nice.
Yeah, there's what you'll find is that there's an initial financing statement, and then there'd probably be a subsequent financing statement that is the continuation of that, because I think some of them say they're only valid for 5 years, and then they do an update later on. So I just spotted one for 2012, so that should be covered there.
Well, excellent. Very interesting, Scott. I wanted to round up the first segment here by talking a little bit more about your websites. And of course, again, plug the movie, the film, for those who haven't seen it. It's called What the Fuck, standing for Frequently Unanswered Questions of the Australian Government. Tell us where people can go to both read more about you and your work and see the movie, and if there's anything else you'd like to share with us, Scott.
Okay, thank you. The website I put together is called truth-now.net. On there is a 2-minute trailer to the documentary and also a link to the full documentary itself. It's 52 minutes. And the name of the documentary, What the F-U-Q, which has been pronounced in various different ways, quite intentionally as well, I'm sure, came about basically from all of these questions that we were putting to this so-called government and not getting any answers. So we just stumbled across the name Frequently Unanswered Questions, and the acronym it spelt was quite a masterpiece. So that's the background to that one.
Well, very good. It's a very interesting film. I recommend it to everybody to also get more on the backstory here, what we've been talking about so far with Scott. We're going to have the links up on redasscreations.com to Scott's website and to the film as well. Well, stay with us, Scott. We'll take a short break here at this point, and then we'll continue with more in the second segment. We'll be right back.